new again. Because everything old is new again. I like it.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
Welcome to City Watch on WBAI 99.5 FM and streaming live around the clock and around the world at WBAI.org. I'm your host, David Brand, reporter for the nonprofit news organization City Limits, coming to you live this morning. Our great engineer, Sean Rhodes, is in the studio, making it all happen as usual. My co-host, Jeff Simmons, is off today. Each week, City Watch brings you the newsmakers, newsbreakers, reformers, performers, movers, and shakers shaping New York City and informing us about our city and surrounding area, as always, with a focus on equity and justice. And today we've got an excellent show featuring three guests reporting on, studying, and tackling some of the most important issues in our city. In a minute, I'll talk with my City Limits colleague and Report for America Corps member, Liz Donovan, about her reporting on the home healthcare industry. Liz recently published an excellent report in the New York Times on the working conditions for the United States' roughly 2.4 million home health aides, including tens of thousands here in New York City. Now, they're typically underpaid, overworked, at risk, and often unaware of their scant worker protections, especially as they continue to fill a crucial role, often at great risk to their own health during the COVID-19 pandemic. After Liz, we'll talk with Dr. Eric Sanderson, a senior conservation ecologist with the Wildlife Conservation Society in New York, the author of Manhattan, A Natural History of New York City and Terra Nova, The New World After Oil, Cars, and Suburbs. Dr. Sanderson studies the historical ecology of New York City, including the rivers, streams, ponds, and marshes of old that have been filled in, covered up, and developed into housing, businesses, and brand new neighborhoods, the very places that seem to bear the brunt of stormwater and flooding, as we saw recently with Hurricane Ida. Now, he wrote a fascinating essay in the New York Times earlier this week that's included in today's Sunday review called Let Water Go Where It Wants to Go. And we're going to talk to him about that, about the history of New York City ecology and flooding today. And finally, we'll talk with Joanne Page, the president and CEO of the Fortune Society, an organization that provides reentry services, including housing, for people leaving New York's jails and prison. And those are services that are even more important now as we see the crisis unfolding on Rikers Island and efforts to ensure more people aren't going to jail and aren't ending up in prison during this time of crisis. Again, you are listening to City Watch on WBAI 99.5 FM. Let's get to our first guest. Liz Donovan covers climate justice and the climate crisis in the city for City Limits. She's my colleague there. Love working with her. But she also recently published an excellent piece on the home healthcare industry for the New York Times. And that article is titled Long Hours, Low Pay, Loneliness in a Booming Industry. It ran on September 15th. Here to talk to us about that is Liz Donovan. Liz, welcome back to City Watch.
Hi, David.
Your piece was heartbreaking, focusing on the experiences of a few home health aides who died as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. It also gives context on the massive growth of the home care industry and the often terrible working conditions and minimal protections that literally hundreds of thousands, millions of workers across the country are experiencing. I want to cite a few numbers that you mentioned in the piece and then ask you a couple questions. But you said there are already about 2.4 million home health aides in the United States, and that number is only set to explode as our population ages and seeks care inside their homes. You have a quote here from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The ranks of home care aides are expected to grow by more than those of any other job in the next decade. It's also among the lowest paying occupations on the list of jobs that the Bureau of Labor Statistics is studying. And in 2019, you write, national spending on home health care reached a high of $113.5 billion, 40% higher than just 6 years earlier in 2013. So, first of all, who is getting that money if these are some of the lowest paying jobs that are only set to explode? And tell us about the people who tend to do these jobs and what the pay and working conditions are like for them.
Yeah. Well, as the article says, we're seeing this rapid growth in senior adults who want to choose to stay in their homes or their communities as they age. Of course, baby boomers are continuing to age. That population is just set to expand so wildly that there's just such a need for workers who are able to help provide this care. It will be even more so in the future. And, you know, that 2019 number, that's, of course, before the pandemic when nursing homes became hotspots for the virus. So we haven't yet even seen how that is going to impact the industry. But the workers are, you know, mostly women of color, mostly immigrants, especially in New York. I think the number was something like 80% immigrant in New York. Mm. And they're paid with taxpayer dollars. It's usually Medicaid. The money is, it's a little bit complicated and it really varies from state to state. But, you know, the agencies, these are the companies that provide the aids. They make a portion of the profits. And then there's also managed care companies, insurance companies that are involved, specifically in New York, that would, you know, take some of that profit as well. So it really depends which state you're looking in and how the funds are just, you know, distributed, how many players are involved in that.
Well, I imagine a lot of people listening right now that are home health care workers or are people whose family members are getting crucial assistance from home health care workers, or maybe their family members are home health care workers. And so, you know, I think we acknowledge the incredible work that they are doing. And your article focuses on two people in particular, and that's Yvette Dessen and Helen Mona, both of whom died of COVID. Can you tell us about them, their experiences, and what makes them representative of the home care industry?
Yeah. One of the first themes that we recognized, reporting partner Mariel Alarcon and I, we noticed that a lot of the women who were in this profession came from their countries of origin, and this was their first professional certificate that they earned. So, you know, it was something that they felt that they were really making progress in their lives. Yvette Dessen, for example, could not read or write. She was not sent to school in Haiti because her dad didn't believe in sending girls to school. So, you know, she came to the States and was able to get a certificate, and as soon as she got it, she had it framed. And then Helen, she came from Guyana, and she spent her whole life working as kind of a caregiver for her family back home in Guyana, and then also for her granddaughter. So when she moved to New York, she wanted to eventually work at a hospital. She was, you know, being a home health care was kind of the first step in that process, her daughter told us. So she was just really committed to, you know, having a professional career and having her own money and eventually being able to travel. These are people who really loved the job. The pay is very low, but it still gave them a sense of financial independence. Yvette, we talk about in the article, was able to buy a home in Queens. That was something that she had really wanted to do for years. So that, and they really care about their patients. Their patients are like family. A lot of these workers spend hours outside of their shift that they're being paid to care for these patients because they don't want to leave if the other aide hasn't showed up or if the family member isn't there or if the person wakes up in the middle of the night and needs care, even though the aide is technically not on the clock. They're committed to providing that care for them.
Well, talk to us about that. The article focuses on this a bit, that many workers are working 24-hour shifts and sleeping at the homes of the people they're serving, but they're not getting paid for that. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah. So that's called it's called a live-in shift, and the workers are basically scheduled for 24 hours, usually for a few days in a row, and they get paid for 13 of those hours because they're supposed to get 8 hours of sleep, 5 hours uninterrupted sleep, and then 3 hours of breaks. But that's just so contradictory to the job. We talk with so many aides who told us, you know, they're woken up in the middle of the night, or even if they do sleep, they sleep with one ear open, you know, waiting to see if the patient stirs. Sometimes these are patients that need to be turned. They worry about patients with dementia getting up in the middle of the night and wandering. So other times, too, the aide only gets like a chair to sleep in, they told us. So you can't really sleep in a situation like that. So although they're supposed to be getting these break times, they really don't. They still don't get paid for it. There's a campaign called Ain't I a Woman campaign in New York City, and they protest at least once a month against the 24-hour shift. Harvey Epstein, an assembly member, Harvey Epstein, has introduced legislation. He actually introduced it originally in 2019, and he reintroduced it in January to put an end to this shift, to split it into two 12-hour paid shifts.
What kind of traction is that legislation getting? I mean, I think I learned about it through your reporting, and then through that, I learned about the 24-hour shift and the efforts to end that shift, or at least get people paid for the full amount of time they're working. What's going on with that legislation, and what can we expect in coming weeks and months?
You know, I don't know. It was in 2019. It was just sitting in committee, and then I think that's still where it is. You reintroduced it, but I don't know if it's gone to a vote yet. I don't think it has.
So it's just, I guess it's kind of buried, and maybe your article could bring some more light to it. I mean, it's just incredible to me that people are working that much, working that hard, and not getting paid for it. When I know for Yvette Destin in the article, you talk about how she was working 60-hour work weeks, several hours a day, not getting paid for a lot of her work. Like, what are some of the tasks that she was actually performing?
So, this depends state to state what home health aides are allowed to do. But she would be, in general, she'd be lifting patients, bathing patients. We wrote this in the article that one of her last days where she was really, really sick, her daughter put a chair in her bathtub and washed her hair for her. And that's something we just thought it was such a touching moment, because that's something that she would do for her patients, but that she said, she told her daughter, I never want to have a home health aide. Like, I never want to have that kind of care. She was just so sick from COVID that she needed that care in that moment. So she would do that. She went on walks with her patients. Her daughter told us if the patient passed away, she and her daughter would go to their funeral. Again, just really caring for the people that she took care of. And for her specific company, they are also supposed to do light housekeeping in the home. So I guess there was that element as well.
What's the the average pay rate here in New York, and I guess nationwide, for home health workers?
You know, it's a minimum wage job. So in New York, that's more. There's also something called wage parity in New York, which a couple more dollars per hour that can be like paid directly as wages or used for benefits, something like that. But I think it's on average, it's less than 11, and it's increased only $1.75 an hour over the last decade when you adjust it for inflation. So it's a minimum wage job. It's, you know, and the other thing about it that we thought was striking is that the economic instability by the job. So a lot of the aides were nervous to call out because they were worried about losing their schedule. They were worried, you know, this patient still needs care, right? So another aide might be assigned to that patient, and then the patient or the family might prefer that aide, or, you know, it just might work out to continue sending that aide to that patient. And now, you know, they get a whole new patient, which could mean a whole new commute. You know, it's not going to an office, it's going to someone's home. So maybe you had a pretty direct commute, and now maybe you have two buses and a subway. And maybe the hours are, you know, it's not the best schedule. So it's almost like being trapped in in your current situation to be able to hold on to the stability of your schedule.
So New York City, it's a minimum wage job, and I think you reported that the average pay was $11 an hour nationwide, which obviously even lower than minimum wage here in New York City. And
right.
People were scared to speak out about the conditions because then they could be punished by not getting shifts and by
right.
not getting new clients.
Exactly. Yeah. They worry about losing their schedule, losing their patients. Yeah, losing, and then therefore losing their already low paycheck and economic stability.
So what kind of protections exist here in New York City for home health care workers?
Well, you know, there's Department of Labor oversees the workers in the industry, and they have a line and an email that you can call to complain. They actually have a task force as well set up that former Governor Cuomo set up a few years ago to kind of oversee low pay industries, and home health care is one of them. There is also something interesting. It's a national protection. It's called the Fair Labor Standards Act that, incidentally, like domestic workers, like home health aides, were not included as part of originally. It was introduced as part of the New Deal. And it was said that, you know, at the time it was Southern politicians kept domestic workers and agricultural workers out of it. It was like a racist exemption from the law. It's labor mm-hmm. protections that like set the work week to 42 hours, whatever it is officially, and banned child labor, et cetera. But these workers were just not included as part of that until 2015. So we actually looked at the data from the Department of Labor and calculated how many back wages were determined to be due to Fair Labor Standards Act violations since that went into effect. It was a huge amount. It was like 47 million nationally. New York was the third highest state, so behind Virginia and Pennsylvania.
Wow. Well, Liz Donovan, it was a great report. We look forward to your continuing reporting on the issue of worker protections, workers' rights for our millions of home care workers across the country and tens of thousands here in New York City. Thank you for joining City Watch.
Thanks for having me.
That was Liz Donovan, a reporter for City Limits and a Report for America Corps member, my colleague over at City Limits, and just came out with a great report on worker protections, worker conditions, and the experience of home health care aides across the country and here in New York City. I encourage you to check it out. It was published by the New York Times on September 15th. Now, you're listening to City Watch on WBAI 99.5 FM, streaming live at our website, wbai.org. I'm your host, David Brand, coming to you live today. You can follow me on Twitter, at David F. Brand. Again, that's at David F. Brand. And again, I'm sure we have a lot of home health aides listening right now, or people whose family members work as home health care, home health aides, or whose family members are in need of services from home health aides. And we definitely acknowledge the hard work that you're doing and the crucial role. And so I think Liz's reporting is so important. Now, our next guest also had a fascinating piece published in the New York Times this week, and I invited him on the show to talk more about it. Dr. Eric Sanderson is a senior conservation ecologist with the Wildlife Conservation Society in New York. He studies the historical ecology of New York City, and he's an expert on the history of New York City geography, including the rivers, streams, ponds, and marshes of old that have since been filled in and turned into neighborhoods, into residential communities, into, in the case of Lower Manhattan, the Tombs Jail and the courthouse complex over there. Now, in the wake of flooding from Hurricane Ida, Dr. Sanderson wrote, "Let Water Go Where It Wants to Go," an essay in the New York Times describing how floodwaters tend to find those old bodies of water and the neighborhoods, homes, and businesses that are now located there. Dr. Eric Sanderson is also the author of the books Manhattan, A Natural History of New York City, and Terra Nova, The New World After Oil, Cars, and Suburbs. We're really happy to have him on the show today. Dr. Eric Sanderson, welcome to City Watch.
Thanks, David. Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. And thanks for joining us. That was a great piece, and really excited to talk to you about it. You know, the New York City we know today didn't always look like the New York City we know today. And I don't mean skyscrapers and apartment complexes. I mean the actual contours of the land, and in many cases, the shape of our waterways. Now, you wrote about that for the Times earlier this week in a great piece describing development on former salt marshes, wetlands, and streams, the very places we see some of the most flooding today. You write, the losses are mainly the result of our inability to read the landscape where we live and can see fully what it means to live there. We need to see the landscape in new, by which I mean old, terms. So can you tell us about that? What do you mean by that? And what are some of the places in New York City that have been most transformed when it comes to filling in our waterways and salt marshes and ponds and streams?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this place that we live, that we call New York City, has only been New York City for 400 years, and it has a history that goes back thousands and even millions of years before that, when this was a forested landscape of hills and valleys and salt marshes down on the shore and lots of streams and freshwater wetlands associated with them. Everywhere in the city, was one of those different ecosystems once upon a time. And those ecosystems changed over time as the climate changed, as sea level changed, as human beings came and went out of this landscape. And so the urban fabric that we've inherited is so large and daunting and seems so immovable that I think it's actually kind of blinded us to other things that are true about our landscape, which is that water falls and it wants to run downhill, and it tends to find out the old streams and water courses in the past. And it's hard for, I have to say, it's hard for, modern New Yorkers, because many of these places along the coast or in the valleys were filled 100 years ago, 200 years ago, in some cases 300 years ago. And then, people built on them, and then they built other things. And so this memory of the former landscape has been lost from most of our imaginations.
What are some of the specific places? I know you mentioned some of them in the essay. What are some of the specific neighborhoods or locations in New York City that we see kind of the water finding its old way?
Right. Well, after Hurricane Ida, I was, reading the press reports and feeling really badly about, the people that died, because they were in basements that flooded, or, how much people lost property. And, watching the video of that subway station at 28th Street, that where the water was just flowing in a flash flood. And we've been building maps for 20 years of where these streams and wetlands were. So I just started putting dots on the map. And I realized that that all of them that I was reading about were in a former wetland. So, for example, the 28th Street subway station on 7th Avenue, just near Madison Square Garden, that was in the middle of an old wetland that used to feed the stream called the Old Rack that went sort of eastward across Manhattan and around the bottom side of Murray Hill and through this little pond called the Sunfish Pond. Did you read that? There was an amazing and, kind of heartrending story about the people that live on 153rd Street in Queens. And, I know a little bit about 153rd Street. I know most of it's, up over the hill in Queens. And so I was kind of struck that I wondered myself, why 153rd? But it turns out that the people that lost so much, and there was this very dramatic picture in the paper of all the stuff that was being thrown out all the way down the street, that block is an inholding in Cascina Park. And Cascina Park is named after Cascina Creek, which used to run down through that part of Queens. And in fact, that block is very close to where Cascina Creek met the Flushing River and then went out to the sea. So in sort of retrospect, of course, it's not very surprising that the flooding happened there. And this is true all over the city, where the Major Deegan flooded is very close to the old, Harlem River, and Tibbetts Brook, which was this winding tidal creek that went through a large salt marsh and what's now the Kingsburg section of the Bronx. I could go on and on, or the parts of Central Park that flooded. Central Park, a big problem from Olmsted when he designed it in the middle 19th century was that it was full of wetlands, and he and his men put down all these drainage panels to try and take off the water. But, you know, they weren't anticipating climate change and just these enormous floods that we're seeing nowadays.
So is this a new problem, or is it getting worse because of climate change?
Well, it's definitely an old problem, and it's something that wouldn't have surprised most generations of New Yorkers, you know, if we would just go back 100 years ago into the early 20th century or into the 19th or 18th century, or the Lenape people, for that matter. I mean, I think they would all recognize that the water goes downhill and it floods into streams, and you don't want to put your house there. I mean, just as a sort of common sense thing. But it's certainly exacerbated by climate change. I mean, in the Bronx where I live, the predictions are that we got 8 inches of rain in about 6 hours that night with Hurricane Ida. And New York City gets about 4 inches of rain per month on average, on long-term average. So that was 2 months of rain in 6 hours. And so that's going to cause flooding. That's going to cause a lot of flooding. And that flooding, that water's going to flow down to the lowest place it can find. That's why it was finding basements. And there's going to be more water concentrating in the lower parts of the landscape.
That's a pretty good way of framing it. I haven't heard it framed like that, 2 months of water in just a few hours. That's pretty nuts.
Yeah, it's completely nuts. I mean, I say 8 inches of rain, but just, you know, get out your pencil and paper, your calculator, and calculate what 8 inches of rain over, say, a square mile of the city is. And it's billions of gallons of water. It's an enormous amount of water.
So we have, you know, estimates range tens of thousands to more than 100,000 basement apartments across the city, many of them, as in the case of the Casina Park area and a little residential carve-out right there in the park where we saw, unfortunately, two people die from flooding in their basement apartment in what once was a stream in marshland. So many people depend on these apartments. So many property owners rent out these units or live on the first floor and are affected. It's a lot of people. So what can we do about it to make sure that they're safe, that the housing is shored up, or that no one is living in these really dangerous areas?
Yeah, well, I totally get it, and I'm so sympathetic for all the losses. And you know, it seems to me that the city has really two very big problems that are running right into each other. One is climate change and all the things we've just been talking about. But the other one is that the city continues to grow. Its population continues to grow because it's such an attractive place to live and there's so many jobs. And that's, of course, causing the, you know, affordable housing crisis that you know, I know you cover, and that, you know, that is driving people to live in these basements. And these two things cannot live with each other. You know, the city cannot absorb water infinitely, and nor can it absorb people infinitely. And so, you know, I think we need to put in policies that help, you know, take this kind of ecological information to account when people make their real estate decisions. I'm not a big fan of, you know, government mandates and requirements as such, although I think it's, you know, I think in retrospect it was a big mistake to build houses in unsafe places, and that causes, you know, a lot of pain and difficulty for the people that live in those places who didn't know until it's a little bit too late. In my book Terra Nova, I actually suggested that our property taxes should be based not just on the economic value of a property, but also on the ecological value of the property, that you would take into account that your house is displacing a marsh or a wetland or a bit of forest, because, you know, forests are all part of the hydrological cycle too, and that would be part of the way you pay your taxes. Because in some sense, you know, every structure is taking from these what we call ecosystem service benefits, these benefits that nature used to give to humanity, and then appropriating that benefit, you know, for private uses, you know. I mean, including me, I'm not trying to single anybody out. It's the same way for me. My house displaced a forest in the Bronx where I live, and that forest, therefore, can't slow the water, can't filter the water, can't sequester carbon, all these sort of things. And so that should be a part of my property tax.
Oh, that's interesting. You mentioned people don't really know what was there before they moved in. And I guess in the case of places that were filled in 100 years ago, even 50 years ago, a homeowner or a renter would probably have no idea that there was a marsh or a stream there before. Is there any way to, short of, I guess, looking at like a historical map of New York City and seeing like, oh, wow, this used to be a river where my street is right now. Is there any way to know what was there before and that you might be at more risk?
Yeah, well, I'm working on a book about those maps, so that's coming. If you're able to do that, but you can also look. The city has this very interesting project where they've been mapping extreme flooding around the city, and they have a website that you can go and look. And if you look, when I look at that map of where 311 calls come in and where they've observed extreme flooding events, it's basically a map of the old streams to my eye. Mm-hmm. So that kind of information is available from the Department of Environmental Protection. And I'd encourage people to look at it. But I'd also encourage people to think about their own experience. You know, if your basement is flooded, you know, 5 times in the last 10 years, well, that's a pretty strong indicator of the hydrological situation about where you are. These things are not acts of God. They're acts of physics and climate change. And you know, nature is all the time giving us signals about what's going on. We just, you know, we have to open our minds and our use our intelligence and our wisdom to hear them.
Are there particular infill projects that really stand out to you? I think the one that stands out to me is how there was a pretty huge pond where we now have like the criminal courthouse in Manhattan, and that it was 5-acre pond that was actually 60 feet deep, the collect pond that got mm-hmm. filled in and built some like pretty crucial institutions on top of it. Can you tell us more about that location and others that might stand out to you?
Sure, that's the collect pond's a classic example. It was this kettle pond in lower Manhattan. It was actually the fresh water source for nearly 200 years of the city's development in the 17th and 18th century. Because, you know, you can't drink the Hudson River and you can't drink the East River because they're really tidal straits. There's salty water. And so, you know, to have a city, you need to have fresh water. And for most of 200 years through the American Revolution, the place New Yorkers got their water was the collect pond. And then shortly after the American Revolution, you know, development started moving north, and in particular, a leather tannery factory set up on the shores of the collect pond. And at the time, the way you got rid of the waste from tanning leather was you just dumped it in the nearest water body, in this case, the fresh water source for the entire city. Hmm. And so it became polluted and really nasty, and no one wanted to drink out of it, which caused this whole set of ramifying events. You know, there was a family that owned this little spring uphill from the collect pond called the Tewater Pump, and they made a lot of money. Aaron Burr helped form a bank or form a company called the Manhattan Water Company to try and bring water from further up Manhattan down to lower Manhattan, or maybe even from the Bronx, like from the Bronx River. And then he used the assets of that company to form a bank to compete with Alexander Hamilton's bank. They actually did build some wooden pipes that apparently you sometimes people find when they're digging in lower Manhattan, but didn't really solve the problem. And it eventually led to the Croton Aqueduct System, which led to, you know, a big reservoir in Central Park that they called Lake Manahatta, which then fed the reservoir at 42nd Street, which is where the public library in Bryant Park is, and then fed all the way down into lower Manhattan. Meanwhile, they built over the top of the collect pond, and there was even very briefly a square laid out there called Paradise Square. But the problem was they hadn't done a very good job filling. You know, they'd put a lot of the kind of marsh vegetation, and they'd knocked the hill down that was right next to it that was formerly full of shell middens from the Lenape. And the buildings that they built on top just started to sink into the collect pond. And so it became a neighborhood where, you know, wealthy people didn't want to live, and so the people that moved in were the early 19th century, you know, poor immigrants, and it became Five Points, the famous Five Points mm-hmm. neighborhood, which was, you know, renowned for its poverty and also for its crime and violence. And the Five Points were five streets that met right on top of the old collect pond. So, you know, fast forward, you know, Abraham Lincoln comes to the city in 1860, gives a speech. He can't believe that these tenements. Charles Dickens comes. He says, I've never seen such squalid tenement conditions as I see in the Five Points. We don't have anything like that in England. In the late 19th century, there was this movement to knock down those tenements. This is sort of what Jacob Riis was documenting. And so they knocked down a bunch of those buildings, and they started building municipal buildings, the courthouses, the New York Supreme Court, the federal building, These things all now stand around what we call Foley Square, but Foley Square is on top of the old Collect Pond. And I've been told that that subway station right there at Foley Square often still floods.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, yet another indication. And the city is just full of these kinds of stories. I mean, you know, before Hurricane Ida, we had Hurricane Sandy in 2012, and it flooded all the salt marshes. And the map of the flooding of from Sandy is 90% the map of the old salt marshes in the city.
Well, it's incredible, and it's really fascinating. And you know, we look forward to that book that you're working on. And I think in the meantime, we can check out some of your other works, Manahatta. And could you remind us of the name of your other book?
Yeah, it's called Terra Nova, The New World After Oil, Cars, and Suburbs.
We got to check those out.
It's a sort of direct, for me, it's in my mind anyway, it's kind of the sequel to Manahatta, because I was sort of struggling with, you know, how did we get the landscape we did? And of course, that's the classic story of oil, cars, and suburbs. But what we really need to do is, you know, figure out a way out of that trap. And, you know, lots of people are working on that now. But I think it all begins with starting to value the land for all the things it can do, not just for its real estate value.
And maybe a good place to start for listeners is to check out today's New York Times Sunday Review and read your essay, Let Water Go Where It Wants to Go. It's a great piece by Dr. Eric Sanderson. And Dr. Sanderson, thank you for joining City Watch.
Thank you so much, David. Have a good day.
You too. Thank you. You are listening to City Watch on WBAI 99.5 FM, streaming live around the clock and around the world at WBAI.org. I'm your host, David Brand, and you can follow me on Twitter at David F. Brand. Again, David F. Brand. We just spoke with Dr. Eric Sanderson, who's a senior ecologist with the Wildlife Conservation Society of New York City, and does really fascinating research on the historical ecology and geography of New York City and how the entire city has changed so much, not just in terms of skyscrapers and apartment complexes and institutions, but really taking what used to be huge ponds or streams or marshlands and turning them into entirely new neighborhoods. And now we see the impact of that, I guess, because of the climate crisis and flooding, like we saw from Hurricane Ida, kind of finding those places that were once historic waterways. Speaking of history, every time you listen to WBAI, you are part of history, because WBAI is a legendary radio station. It's a New York City institution for 60 years, working on 60 more. And we couldn't do it without you, our listeners. So before we get to our next guest, who I know is on the line, Fortune Society President and CEO Joanne Page, I want to just do a quick plug for our historic radio station, and hoping that the listeners who we depend on can go one step further and become contributors by visiting give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. While you're there, check out the great merchandise. We have masks, t-shirts, there's albums, there's other pieces of swag on sale there, but really, I wouldn't consider it a sale. I'd say you're making a contribution to a station that you love listening to, and you get a little reward in the process. There's books, but I encourage you to check out the t-shirts. I think I say this every time I do the show, but I am wearing my WBAI t-shirt right now. I was wearing my WBAI mask yesterday. It gets me pumped up, gets me in the zone to do the show. We always have great guests here. Always really fascinating to talk with the reporters, the researchers, the lawmakers, policymakers who come on the show. And, you know, we couldn't do it without you, our listeners. And if you want to go one step further, become a BAI buddy, a sustaining contributor, you can do that by going to give2wbai.org and clicking buddies. If you don't want to go online, you can also make a contribution by calling our call center at 212-209-2950 and say you want to become a BAI buddy. Again, that's 212-209-2950. You know, a lot of people listening to the show, a lot of people probably can't make a contribution at the moment. That's totally fine. We totally understand that. But maybe you listening right now are capable of making that contribution. You can do it for yourself and also on behalf of listeners who aren't in the financial position to do it. So please consider making that cash contribution, keeping us on the air, keeping WBAI alive for 60 years and 60 more. Just go to givetowbai.org. Thank you for that. Now again, I'm your host, David Brand, coming to you live this morning and having a great show so far, so let's keep it going. We are seeing a crisis on Rikers Island right now, and I know we have a lot of listeners on Rikers, and if you're listening on in jail right now, we hope you're safe. We hope everyone is safe. And here to talk to us about what's going on there and about some of the efforts to serve people coming out of jail, coming out of prison, is our next guest, Joanne Page. She's president and CEO of the Fortune Society. In that role, she leads one of the nation's most respected nonprofit organizations serving and advocating for formerly incarcerated individuals. Over her 32-year career at Fortune, Joanne is credited with creating and cultivating many of the organization's signature programs, including housing initiatives, substance abuse treatment programs, career development, career training, family services, and health and mental health programs. Joanne Page, welcome to City Watch.
David, it's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So, mentioned it a moment ago, but we see this crisis unfolding at Rikers. People are getting sick. Unfortunately, people are dying. People are taking their own lives. There's a major staffing shortage, and seems like relative inaction at the highest levels of city government. But amid all of that is a push to, first of all, keep people from going to jail and to keep people, to get people out and to keep them from returning. So tell us about how Fortune is responding to the crisis and ensuring that people are not returning to jail once they get out.
Well, first of all, we've been part of the push to close Rikers because Rikers is not a place fit for human habitation. And I was listening to your previous guest, Dr. Sanderson. Mm-hmm. When we first started talking about closing Rikers, we were really excited about the idea that that could be a place where more affordable housing could happen. And then further research showed that it is built on landfill, and there are toxic gases that come from it, and it's not fit for human habitation. So the plan for Rikers is to be using it to handle New York City's waste once it's closed down. So it has never been a place fit for human habitation. And there are numerous reasons, right? One is the facilities are built in a way that does not foster rehabilitation, that is punitive, that is dangerous, that's extraordinarily staff expensive in terms of what it takes to staff it. And that just is a violation of every value we hold about how human beings should be treated. But we have two new things that have happened. One is that COVID has happened, and that means that it's more dangerous than ever for people to be locked up there. I mean, if you wanted to figure out how to spread COVID, keeping people in an intake unit right up against each other, crowded so they don't have the ability to even lie down in the time of COVID, and having most people being released to the community is deadly from a public health perspective and just unconscionable from a human decency perspective. And then the other is we're seeing unprecedented absence of people coming to work. A third of the correction officers are just not on the job every day. So there's a confluence of circumstances that's creating a crisis. And part of what's exacerbating it is that judges are not following the law in terms of bail reform and are locking up people who should be released on their own recognizance or should be released to supervised release.
I saw some statistics that judges are setting bail on more often now on certain offenses than they were even before the bail reform law took effect. And so I guess the result of that is more people going to Rikers who might otherwise have been released to, I guess, supervised released or, as you said, released on their own recognizance to stay at home and await their trial. So how does Fortune Society help people if they are being released, I guess, pre-trial? And then talk about helping people who are released from upstate prisons.
So we have a very robust alternative to incarceration program, and we're in court regularly. We're in all boroughs except Staten Island, and we're in court regularly advocating to have people released either to our alternative to incarceration program or to be released to other programs. But the biggest way, I think, in which we make a difference right now is about housing. Hmm. So we will advocate to get people who are homeless released from detention and to use our housing as a way of keeping people from being locked up in the first place. There's a city version of this and there's a state version of this. The state version is actually rather appalling. About half the people released from New York State Prison to New York City end up in New York City's shelters as the place where they're released.
Yeah, I think so we should. I just want to stop you for a moment because I think we do need to highlight that. That it's pretty like astounding that half of people being released from upstate prisons into back to New York City are going right into New York City homeless shelters, fueling the homeless crisis, and also kind of seems like setting people up for failure after their release.
It also ties into the Rikers Island issue, because one of the group populations that's growing most are people who are parole violators. And if you take somebody who's been in prison and you put them in one of the large barrack-style New York City shelters that are often rife with drug abuse and with violence, some of them flee, and then they end up with a technical violation because they're not where they got released to. But it's really easy for people to get sucked back into drugs use and into violence. So they're a setup for failure, if you will. And they're also a very expensive setup for failure. And then Rikers is the most expensive setup for failure of all. It's stunning to know that we spend over $400,000, over $400,000 per person to lock them up in Rikers for a year. And the human cost is, I don't know how you measure it. So what we've learned is that for people who are homeless, getting out of state prison, if we can give them a stable place to land with very solid services, many are able to move into the community on their own and just go on about their lives. Others need transitional housing, and with the right supports, they can move out on their own again. And some need permanent supportive housing. So we've developed a continuum of housing that does those three things. Emergency housing for somebody who comes in with no documents, no money, no track record, nothing except some hope for a better life. Transitional housing to help people get more stable when they need those supports. And then for people who really have life challenges that mean that they cannot live on their own, permanent supportive housing. And we've also learned that on the detention side, if we can provide a place for people to land who otherwise would be homeless, we can keep them out of jail.
Well, and I think that's the ultimate goal. And, you know, your organization provides these services for, you know, a lot of people, but still just a fraction of the people in need. So what would it take to bring these types of services to scale for many more people leaving upstate prisons or leaving Rikers or trying to avoid Rikers pre-trial?
You know, I think we have a unique opportunity right now, and that is because of the city's economic situation and the fact that hotels can be turned into housing at roughly half the cost and a third of the time that it takes to build housing from scratch. So we are at this point working on building a new building in East Harlem, and that's basically a five-year plan. But we're also looking at being able to buy a hotel, and we might be able to open the doors in a year if we do that. So I think New York City has real opportunity, but this is the point. This is not a question of should we pay the money to do it. This is a situation of we're already paying the money and then some, but for things that don't yield the human and societal results that we need. You know, there's been study after study about permanent supportive housing and how it saves multiple dollars when you spend a dollar. But we're spending over $400,000 to lock people up in hell in Rikers Island. We could be doing so much better with our dollars and with the lives of people we're talking about. I think we want to bring this to scale.
I mentioned
what we've done has shown that it works, and some of our partners have done the same. And New York State actually asked us to replicate our housing model in upstate New York. And we did the technical assistance to help a really good nonprofit Center for Communities Alternatives, replicate our Castle and Castle Gardens model in Syracuse. It's possible to take what we know and build this to scale, and it would yield huge social benefits.
Fortune also rents out apartments in private residences and then works with tenants once they are housed in those places. And I mentioned on Twitter that I was going to be interviewing you today, and so a lot of property owners started tweeting at me about a specific instance where Fortune rented out a unit in a Queens, I think, three-family home, and it became a nightmare scenario for the property owner where the tenants were really making life hell there. And that one specific example seems to be used as like evidence for why property owners should not participate in these programs. But I wonder if you want to address that and talk about how common issues like that are and about that kind of community housing program.
Sure. We have about 350 apartments that are permanent supportive housing, and the majority of them, around 230, are scattered site apartments. And this situation, I can't tell you how much it troubles us, and we've done everything we possibly can and could about it, but it's a very rare instance. And in fact, we had worked with that landlord on prior occasions without any tenant issues. So we have worked to try to evict this family, and we got stuck in the fact that there is a ban on eviction. We have tried to do a number of things. I can't talk about a particular person because of confidentiality reasons, but I will say this is a highly unusual situation. We feel terrible about it, and we are going to do, as we've told the landlord, everything we possibly can to do any repairs once the tenant is out. So we have been paying rent throughout all of this. So he has been made whole financially, but he has a tenant who he is deeply troubled about, and justifiably so. And we feel terrible about it, and we're doing what we can to make him whole. But that is an aberration, and we have many landlords we work with who know that we pay them. Even during the time when people were not paying rent, our tenants were being paid rent for because we were paying the rent. So occasionally there is a really bad tenant, but it's a very rare thing among the people we serve.
Well, thank you for addressing that. And Joanne Page, President and CEO of the Fortune Society, really thank you for joining City Watch. Where can we find out more about Fortune's work? And I guess right now, advocacy efforts to ensure people are safe on Rikers, ensure people are not going there in the first place, and ensure people are getting housing while they're leaving jail and prisons.
I think that our website, fortunesociety.org, is a good place to start. But I'd like to put one more note in here, and that is that as important as temporary and emergency housing is, it's essential that when people are ready to leave, they're not leaving back to homelessness. And we're very proud of our Castle, our main transitional housing, because in the last fiscal year, out of our emergency housing, 83% moved to transitional or permanent housing, and out of our transitional housing, 79% moved to permanent housing, or 4% of them moved to residential drug treatment. So we want to look at not only the short-term outcome, which is getting somebody out of jail, but the longer-term outcome, which is, do you keep them out of jail? Do you keep them out of homelessness? And what we know is that our model does that. We can just do better than what we're doing, and we can do it using only a fraction of the money we're currently spending to do it badly.
Well, Joanne Page, President and CEO of Fortune Society, thank you for joining City Watch.
Thank you. Thanks again, and thanks for your really great writing on this issue.
Thank you very much. You are listening to City Watch on WBAI 99.5 FM and streaming live, WBAI.org. Coming up on the end of the show here, and I want to thank everyone for tuning in. Again, I'm your host, David Brand, and you can follow me on Twitter, where I'm at David F. Brand. Again, that's at David F. Brand. I want to thank our great guests. First off was City Limits and Report for America journalist, my colleague, Liz Donovan. Then we had Dr. Eric Sanderson of the Wildlife Conservation Society and Joanne Page President and CEO of the Fortune Society. Thank you all for joining us today. Of course, I want to thank our engineer, the great Sean Rhodes, holding it down in the studio. On next week's City Watch, my co-host Jeff Simmons is back, and he'll be exploring more New York City history, and this is pretty cool. He'll be talking with Joshua Jelly Shapiro, who will discuss his new book, Names of New York, Discovering the Past, Present, and Future Through Its Placemaking Names. Sounds like a really cool book. And Melinda Hunt, president of the Heart Island Project. Now, you got to have to tune into that next Sunday, 10 a.m., City Watch on WBAI 99.5 FM. Thank you, everybody. Remember, COVID-19 is a justice issue. Stay masked up, get vaxxed up. See you soon.
Good morning. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York. City Watch came to you live over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Coming up at 11 o'clock is Radio Free Aaron with John McDonough and Maliki McCourt.
Please stay tuned. This is WBAI New York. The election for the local station board is currently underway with 27 listener candidates.
Hello, fellow listeners. My name is Errol Maitland. Some of you may associate me with programs named Emanation, Wake Up Call, and Democracy Now! I plead guilty. WBAI and the entire Pacifica network must be preserved and strengthened because it cannot be duplicated or replaced. We must invest in growth through partnership in order to press our message of peace and justice. I am committed to ensuring that WBAI respects its listeners and that we become intergenerational again.
I want WBAI to do more and be more, and I'm willing to work for it. I'm Bunupti Kamithu, known to many as Jeff Monroe. I'm passionate about WBAI and appreciative of the education that I have had here. I would like regular coverage of the full listening area, which goes beyond the five boroughs. There are issues and concerns in northern New Jersey, on Long Island, and definitely in Westchester and Rockland counties that warrant the WBAI treatment. We too support the station and its mission. I have experience in community access TV and would like to help create systems of meaningful outreach.
My name is Nick Nicolutis. I'm an adjunct professor at CUNY. I believe in the power of community radio to inform and reflect the community's values and politics, and I'm running for the local station board to support the mission of WBAI to give a voice to the community who supports it and to build a powerful network of listeners, supporters, and allies to keep WBAI publicly owned.
I am Catherine O'Sullivan, and I'm a performing artist. I get involved. I believe in preserving our independent, diverse, uncensored voices on WBAI and the wider Pacifica network. I'm opposed to giving up any of our independence. We must keep working on our financial stability, completing audits in a timely fashion, getting grants and fundraising. I'm Catherine O'Sullivan. Vote for me and my colleagues running on the Indy slate.
This is Hazel Pinder, and I am a local station board member. I'm running again because I believe that a strong BAI is essential and has played a significant role in building diverse radical movements. WBAI has contributed to my own education on social justice issues. I'm a retired school teacher who often incorporated some of the programming into my lessons. I want to help build a brighter future for WBAI, and with your vote, I will be an advocate for growth and change.
Matthew Reiss here, R-E-I-S-S. I cover the rackets, sham elections, aborted democracies, news, sports, and weather. I was a preschool student in AOC's district when less than 1% of America protested and ended the Vietnam War, thanks to TV coverage. Today, however, the media does not question authority. The task falls exclusively to BAI. Fortunately, the BAI electorate may be the most capable political cadre this side of the border.
To learn more about WBAI's local station board candidates and to vote in this election, visit elections.pacifica.org.